Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Hercules Invictus and Athena Victory celebrates the mythic impulses of ancient Greece and Rome, and they invite you to celebrate with them. Welcome to Voice of Olympus.
Greetings! I am Hercules Invictus.
And Athena Victory.
Thank you for joining us tonight, and welcome to the Voice of Olympus e-radio show on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Tonight, I'm very excited. We have an author and Renaissance paranormal investigator whose work I admire greatly, Nick Redfern. Greetings, Nick. Welcome to Voice of Olympus.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's going awesome. How's it going with you?
I'm good, thanks. Other than the fact we got a sudden thunderstorms came in about 2 hours ago, so the house is shaking and the sky's kind of grey and dark. So, but it has dropped the temperature a little bit, which is good.
That is good, and I guess Zeus likes the fact that you're on the show tonight, and he's making his presence known to you down in Texas.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Now, Nick, you have had a very wide-ranging career in the investigation of mysteries. What first inspired you to start on that path?
Well, when I was about 6 or 7, my parents took me on a week's holiday to Scotland, and we spent a day at Loch Ness, and my dad told me the story of the Loch Ness Monster, and when you're sort of like a little kid, you know, sort of hearing a story like that, it gets you sort of excited and fires up your imagination. And as I sort of got a little bit older, I began reading books by people like John Keel, who wrote Mothman Prophecies, and Brad Steiger particularly. It was John Keel and Brad Steiger, probably the two that I read more than any other when I was sort of in my early teens thereabouts. And then when I left school, I began working on a local like a What's On magazine in the town I was living at the time when I was about 17, and it's called Zero, and I basically did all the sort of music reviews and concert reviews and that kind of stuff, and after a while I thought, well, why not try and combine the background in journalism with the interest that I got in the paranormal? And so after a few years of sort of regular jobs and things like that, I decided to take the plunge, and it was basically a case of, you know, either I'll manage to make it full-time or I won't, you know, it'll be back to 8 to 5 or whatever. And fortunately, you know, I sort of stuck by my guns and did what I had to do, and it paid off, you know. And so since then I've focused chiefly on my two big areas of interest, one being UFOs and the other one being cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals. And I kind of sort of split the writing in between those areas, you know, sort of I'll do a UFO book and then like a Bigfoot book and then an ancient aliens book, then a chupacabra book. So, you know, I mean, not just for the sake of the reader, so they've got variation, but so I've got a bit of variation as well, you know, as I'm writing.
And you've written over 30 books. That is quite impressive.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, I try and do about, sort of about two or three a year, and I've been writing books for about 21 years, something like that now. So, so I've sort of kept up a momentum, and you know, as long as I can do it, and I've got the enthusiasm, I'll keep doing it. So hopefully that'll be a long time.
We have something in common. John Keel and Brad Steiger. Brad Steiger was, of course, one of my favorites and one of my inspirations. And we got to work with him years ago in Pennsylvania when we had other radio shows. And Brad Steiger was a frequent guest. And John Keel, I had the pleasure of being in his Fortean Society in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to attend meetings there all the time. Antonio Junius, there were Stanton, there were like all those guys used to get together once a month there in Manhattan with John. And that was a treat, and I'm glad that that was a part of my life as well.
Yeah, that's very cool. I never got to meet Keel, but I mean, for me, some of his books, you know, well, I mean, his books are some of the most important, like Operation Trojan Horse, Mothman Prophecies, Cosmic Question. You know, he kind of really influenced me to think outside of the box and not just look at like the nuts and bolts aspect of UFOs or the flesh and blood aspect of Bigfoot, but to realize that many of these weird phenomena that seem separate are actually somehow interlinked. You know, it's all part of some bigger mystery. And, a lot of researchers today, they still steer away from that, but I think Keel was actually onto something very important when he realized that a lot of these, as I said, these weird mysteries aren't separate. There's some interlocking things somewhere if we can figure out what it is.
He did a great job of expressing that in Disneyland of the Gods, one of his later
books. That just kind of pointed out that one perhaps more than any of the others, the sort of absurdity of a lot of these cases, not in the sense that they're unlikely or hoaxy, I don't mean by that, but absurd in the sense that when you look into them, like Bigfoot, you know, Keel pointed out, when you look into Bigfoot, you find that the case or the subject matter itself is just filled with bizarre stuff that you wouldn't expect to see if it was just a regular unknown type of ape, but, you know, but there's so many strange things surrounding Bigfoot that you just cannot look at it like that. And Keel did sort of a really good job of demonstrating that and demonstrating it with UFOs and lake monsters and all sorts of stuff that, you know, we're clearly not seeing the full picture.
You first came to my attention as somebody to look out for during one of your monsterology books. I think it was called Monster Hunter. And then after that, I kept an eye out for everything that you came out with. And kind of followed what you were doing because that was, to me, that was a phenomenally excellent book. I've been investigating local mysteries my entire life, and when we lived in Pennsylvania, we had something called the Regional Folklore Society, and we would investigate active cases. The weirdest one we had was some a possum-like creature that slithered like a snake and had red glowing eyes, and three or four generations of people in that part of the Pocono Mountains have been experiencing this. So we never figured out exactly what it was, but it was very fun to investigate it for a while.
Well, what was interesting was it caused intense fear.
Yes.
And nobody in the family spoke about it until we were talking to them and interviewed. And then all of a sudden they realized three generations they'd been seeing the same creature. And then after that, they abruptly stopped talking to us.
And we live near Carbondale also, where there was a bell-shaped UFO and there were strange apes and things like that. And we got to talk to a lot of people who actually witnessed things. It was very interesting.
Well, I mean, it's interesting what you said about the red eyes, because red eyes are sort of typically reported in a lot of strange creature cases, whether it's sometimes like out-of-place black panthers or so-called black panthers, Bigfoot, werewolf, dogman-type creatures. They're very often reported with these sort of these strange red eyes. And, you know, I think it's, again, we've sort of seen a parallel there that there's something bigger going on. So, that's an interesting point that you brought up.
Well, don't most animals' eyes reflect green rather than red?
Yeah, that's... That's right. That's why it is actually quite strange that people talk about not just red eyes, but in many cases they describe them as being like self-illuminating red eyes rather than, you know, reflecting off an outside light.
And then there's that smell of sulfur that that people keep reporting too.
Yeah, people report that quite extensively in Bigfoot-type cases. I investigated a number of those. And also, weirdly enough, a number of Men in Black cases where there's been like a smell of sulfur or brimstone in the direct vicinity of the Men in Black. And, of course, you know, the Men in Black appeared in the Mothman saga in the 60s. So, you know, it sort of goes in an entire circle where all of these things come together in some way.
Speaking about Men in Black, you recently released a book on the Women in Black. That was something that I had heard whispers about, but not very much information on. So I'm looking forward to reading that book.
Well, that's sort of a little bit, a bit of a departure in the sense that, you know, nobody's sort of ever written a book on the Women in Black before. But the reason why I wrote it is because between 2006 and 2015, I wrote three books on the Men in Black. And of course, when you write a book on a particular subject, people who've had their own experiences contact you, you know, with their own similar stories. And so a lot of people contacted me and still do contact me about their Men in Black experiences. But perhaps for every, you know, 10 or 15 of a Man in Black story, I would get a similar one, but involving a woman in black. And so over time, I was able to put more and more of these stories together and dig into them further and, you know, demonstrate that there's a pattern there that, although they're, you know, not necessarily as well known as the Men in Black, but there's no doubt that their significance and presence is actually a major part of the sort of the Men in Black mystery. You know, it's like a side project of it, but it's not small in nature. You know, you can find these stories all over the place and across several centuries as well.
Yeah, very, very fascinating. Folklore is a living thing. I'm Greek, and I was fortunate enough to have experienced Greece during a time when it was very medieval before it became modern. And people believed in a corpus of tales that they hid from outsiders until they got to know them. But it was a mythic universe that they found themselves in. And I grew up with this, so it can be argued I still live in the mythic universe of my ancestors, although it's transplanted here. Those stories are very, very much alive. When we had the Regional Folklore Society, we didn't try to prove the truth or the reality of the stories because we focused instead on the fact that these people believed in the story and their belief affected their life and felt if their life affected the culture around them. So we kind of focused on that aspect of the reality more.
Yeah, I mean, where I'm originally from in England, I mean, you can go outside of the big cities and you're soon in sort of the little villages where they haven't changed, you know, for 200 or 300 years. I mean, the village I grew up is actually 1,100 years old right now. And, you know, a lot of those ancient traditions of goblins and, you know, the little people and things like that, those traditions sort of still hold. You know, people don't write them off. And as I said, particularly in the more isolated villages, you know, you'll find that they, won't say they don't like outsiders, that's wrong, but they have their own belief systems and, you know, ways that the rest of the country sort of have moved on from. But it demonstrates, you know, you don't have to get far out of, you know, the cities, etc., and you suddenly find yourself back in the sort of, you know, the old times where you'd expect to see, you know, how you'd expect to see it in like some old 19th century style horror movie, you know, one of these old Count Dracula films. You actually find that kind of atmosphere in a lot of the old English towns and villages.
And a lot of those creatures in those old movies do pop up in cryptozoological explorations as well. So it's really interesting how that artificial mythology becomes part of the living mythology because it enters our psyches and then finds expression through our experience.
Yeah, you're right. And I think when you look at these old stories, You know, we have stories like from the 1500s and 1600s of werewolves. And people today see similar things, but they call it the Dogman. In the same way people see Bigfoot today, you can go back to the sort of 1200s and the 1300s in England, where they had reports of what were known as wild men, or wild men of the woods. But when you look at the stories, they were essentially hair-covered humanoid creatures. So, you know, you can... We can demonstrate there sort of a parallel between what people see today and saw in the past. And there was sort of a big cultural thing hundreds and hundreds of years ago of phantom black dogs, as they became known, again with bright, shiny red eyes. And one of these stories actually inspired Arthur Conan Doyle to write his Sherlock Holmes novel, The Hound of the Baskervilles. That's where he got the idea from one of these existing legends. And... the black dogs were sort of perceived as like a grim reaper type creature, if you like. You know, you see it, someone's going to die or you're going to die, that kind of thing. And but today, the reports of the black dogs are far less, but people have reported all across the UK sightings of these mysterious so-called black panthers, which, like the black dogs, we never catch. And they're very elusive and there are some supernatural overtones with them. So it's almost as if the old mythology has kind of been upgraded for the modern era, from ghostly phantom black dogs to sort of sleek black panther type animals.
When we first moved out to Pennsylvania, the first cryptid we'd heard of, in fact, was a black panther in the area. We were at the recycling and just talking to people, asking about, you know, we investigated legends and things like that. And that was the first thing that came up, that it usually gets spotted around 3 a.m. and they listed some places where we're likely to see it. And it had never been caught. People shot at it, missed it, and so forth. Every now and then we would get a report that a mountain lion or some mountain lion cubs, which weren't supposed to be there either anymore, was hit by a car, but nothing we could substantiate.
Yeah, that's, again, sort of one of the classic aspects of so many of these creatures, that they always elude us. You know, bullets, when people think they were absolutely certain they'd shot the creature, they can only think, well, we must have missed. You know, you get that so many in Bigfoot cases and big cat. You know, I won't say big cats, but these sort of mysterious black cats that get reported all across the planet. We get reports of Australia, the UK, rest of Europe, the US, And very often these cases are sort of tied in with paranormal phenomena where, you know, like, for example, the Black Panther haunts an old bridge or a graveyard or a cemetery. And again, you know, this leads me to believe that we're dealing maybe with some sort of supernatural creature rather than something that's escaped from a zoo or something like that.
Well, I think especially in Britain, where some of the nobility had their own private menageries, that some of the animals could have started from there.
Well, yeah, I think that does account for some of them. But, I mean, we get sort of literally like hundreds a year, 300 or 400 a year, like more than one a day. You know, and in a country the small size of the UK, you would think we would have at least captured some of them. But that hasn't happened. But I do think you're right. I do think you're right when you say that in the past they did have these menageries and certainly some, like, travelling menageries. That would go from town to town like an early circus. And I wouldn't be surprised if in some cases, you know, something like a large cat or a chimpanzee may have escaped and could have inspired at least some of these stories.
I forget what it was. I think it was last year they found the remains of a gigantic hound in England, and it had to do with some local legend that they were talking about this giant dog or whatever. And they actually found the bones, the skeleton of a giant hound that fit the description.
Yeah, that actually is a little village in the south of England, in the east of England, called Bungay, B-U-N-G-A-Y. And if you go to the village of Bungay, they have this story, this legend of this sort of fiery-eyed, blazing-eyed, huge black hound that would sort of haunt the village, and it was sort of like a devilish type creature. But yeah, you're right. Just a couple of years ago, archaeologists who were digging in the area of the old church actually dug up the skeleton of this huge dog. You know, it's the sort of thing you would not want to sort of tackle, you know, like the ultimate guard dog. I mean, it would have been about sort of 6 feet long. It was the bone structure. If you look at it, the photographs, which you can see online, I mean, it was a huge dog.
It looked
like a mastiff or something like that. What's that? Sorry, you broke up a little bit.
No, it was sort of like a cross between a pit bull and a Irish wolfhound. It was just huge.
Yeah, it was just gigantic. And so, again, you know, I think with some of these cases, we were dealing with legitimately like a very vicious, huge dog that may have been sort of a hunting hound or as a guard dog, you know, and the people of the castle got their hands on the biggest, most vicious dog they could find. And people saw it. And back then, 500 years ago, you know, legends became attached to it that it was sort of a devil dog, if you like.
Now, you've become a legendary figure yourself. According to things I was able to pick up from the internet, you are part of something called the Cabal, or the Brat Pack of Paranormal Investigations, and you're pushing for government disclosure.
I actually did see that, but that was really nothing to do with me. That started as a joke by a friend of mine in Canada called Paul Kimball, and he said, oh, you know, let's create this cabal kind of thing, you know, like a rat pack. But, you know, you can only have a rat pack if, I pointed this out to Paul, I said, well, Paul, you know, you can only have a rat pack and do, if you actually do stuff together and hang out. You know, Paul lives in Canada, I live in the US, in Dallas. Another guy who was put forward, I remember Greg Bishop, a good friend of mine, Greg lives in Los Angeles. So, and I haven't seen Paul for probably 7 years, so, you know, it was just started as a joke, and, you know, and then he got picked up by people who thought, oh, you know, these guys hang out in Vegas or whatever in tuxedos, and, you know, which has never, ever happened. I don't even own a tuxedo, thank goodness. But yeah, but it was funny how it took off, and, you know, it did make its way to the internet, which everything makes its way to the internet at some point.
And it spreads like wildfire.
Yeah, but, you know, as things do on the net. But, I mean, it didn't bother me. For me, it was just like a joke thing, but people kind of took it serious.
That was one of the places where I found that, so it's on the Wikipedia page, I think.
Oh, God.
But you are, however, the leader of the United States Fortean Society. Is that correct?
Well, I used to run the U.S. office of what's called the Center for Fortean Zoology, yeah. The Center for Fortean Zoology is a group that was established by a friend of mine, John Downs, who lives in the southwest of England. And John's group is actually one of the few worldwide groups that operates on a full-time basis. It's sort of self-funded, and they launch expeditions. They've been looking for the so-called Russian Bigfoot, which known as the Almasty. They've been on expeditions looking for that. They went to the Congo looking for lake monsters, to Siberia looking for this creature, very similar again to Bigfoot, and also to Mongolia, where there's this report of this strange creature known as the Mongolian Death Worm. So what I did for a long time, and I still work for them now, but what I did for a long time was to sort of coordinate the U.S. office, and we have regional representatives who, you know, if there's a report in, I don't know, Idaho or Montana or wherever, you know, we've got people in those states who can go out and interview the witnesses. So it acts as sort of a good network, you know.
Yes, that sounds awesome. Once we're retired and our responsibilities to individuals are less than they currently are, we intend on traveling the planet too and exploring things and spending a decade or two doing that until we can't do it anymore.
Well, the good thing is, you know, I mean, you don't actually have to go far. I mean, yeah, there's certainly a lot of overseas-type creatures, but, I mean, even in the U.S., I mean, you can go to all across the U.S. and find lake monster reports, dogmen, Bigfoot, you know, you name it. They're here, there, and everywhere. In pretty much every state has got at least sort of two or three well-known cryptids, whether it's, you know, things like Ogopogo or Champ, Bigfoot, you know, then you have the skunk ape in Florida and Louisiana. Yeah, they're pretty much everywhere. So, yeah, it's good to sort of head out overseas and, you know, see the different cultures and countries, but also, you know, you really don't have to go that far at all.
We do that here locally. We're fortunate to live in New Jersey, which has a reputation for bizarreness or weirdness.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange and interesting how some states seem to have sort of far more presence of certain creatures than others. For example, Pennsylvania has a lot of reports of Bigfoot-type creatures.
Yes.
The Pacific Northwest gets a lot of Bigfoot ones too. Here in Texas, where I live, we get a lot of river monsters and lake monsters, but unlike sort of the Loch Ness Monster, which, you know, it's a flesh and blood animal, it's an unknown type of creature, the ones we get in Texas seem more like oversized regular fish, like a catfish or an oarfish, which is a very odd-looking creature, or an alligator gar, which, again, is a very strange-looking fish. It's called an alligator gar because it looks like an alligator, but they're actually a fish which grows to about 10 feet long, but there are reports of people seeing them sort of 15 to 20 feet long. So in that sense, you can easily understand how sort of a legend of a monster develops, and sometimes it may well be an unknown animal. On other occasions, it just might be a really giant-sized, overgrown one, in the same way, you know, that you get giant people now and again.
When we lived in Pennsylvania, there were a lot of that type of reports, other than the weird slithering possum or badger or whatever that was. There were lots of giant animals, like you mentioned, giant fish, giant turtles.
Well, we saw a giant turtle. There was a group of men on the side of the road, and they looked like they were trying to move a dining room table. And I looked, and it was the shell of a turtle. They were trying to get this huge snapping turtle. Which I wouldn't have gone near, but they're trying to push it back towards the water, or they were looking at it. I don't know what they were doing with it, but I was thinking, gee, we swim in that lake. Not anymore.
Yeah, you have to be careful with things like snapping turtles. I mean, they don't call them snapping turtles for no reason. You know, they'll take your foot off or your toes off at least. And, you know, the important thing to remember is that animals like this, regular large animals, you know, they can be right on top of you before you know anything about it. I mean, a good example, I did a TV shoot about 5 or 6 years ago up in Oklahoma where there'd been a chupacabra report, and the team, which was from Fox News, wanted to get some stock footage. So I said, well, you know, we'll go down by the local lake and I can talk about how, you know, if it's an animal, then it's going to need a local water supply, and it's got a perfect one there. So we got down by the side of the water, and the woman who was the main reporter, she said, oh, look, there's some chupacabra tracks on the ground. And I looked at them, and they weren't. They're actually pretty large-sized alligator prints. So I said, oh, they're not from chupacabra. Those are alligator prints. And I've never seen a film crew run as fast as they did, you know. So you have to be aware sometimes that these things can sneak up on you. Tragically, you know, like that little boy, unfortunately, you know, at Disney the other week.
Yes.
That can happen. I mean, that happened, you know, on Disney's property. When you think of that, you imagine what it's like in the wild. There actually are, you know, genuine hazards. You know.
When I was a child on the island of Poros in Greece, Poros is very steep and deep, the water surrounding the island. Some kid was playing ball, and the ball fell in the water, and he climbed down to get it, and the shark grabbed him.
Well,
and I witnessed that. Nobody saw the shark before then. It was over before anybody had a chance to react to it. So I know what you mean about, you know, these things can be upon you before you know it.
Well, even large animals like bears.
Like bears,
They're quiet for despite the strength, their size, I mean.
Yeah, we just came back from West Milford, which is on the other side of northern New Jersey. And there they have giant bears. And we lived there for a while, and bears were something you got used to seeing every day outside your window, on the way to the car.
Yeah, they're black bears. But the thing is, if you were not from the West Milford area and used to seeing them, people would totally freak out because they're like, how can they live up there with those bears? And like, well, usually bears can bother you.
And they're huge, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, bears, you know, they're notoriously sort of, you know, their tempers can change in a second. You know, they can go wild, and then they'll be on you the next second.
Oh, yeah, there was a young man killed in West Milford last year, which
last
was
year.
Wasn't something that usually happened, but I think they got too close to the bear, and the bear killed him.
So folks at home, be careful of large animals, be they biological or multidimensional or spectral. They can get you. And on that happy note, we're going to take our mid-show break for a few minutes. We'll be back to speak with Nick Redfern.
And our midpoint musical interlude today is Bone Poets Orchestra with Contact Strange World.
We have nothing but International Pagan Radio, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week streaming radio station. We have informative Facebook page, interactive Facebook group, absorbing interviews with musicians, engaging shows with excellent hosts, and dynamic interviews with spiritual leaders. Come join us. We have the very best pagan music from around the world. We feature artists such as Dave the Bard, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, Elaine Silver, Izon, Brian Hinkey, Robin Renee, Fawn, and so many more, all available for your listening pleasure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are also available on TuneIn Radio, so go to www.internationalpaganradio.com. It's all pagan, all the time.
You're listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Thanks for sticking around. And now, back to the show.
We are back. And I seem to have pressed the wrong button. Athena, what did we listen to there?
We actually listened to the Bone Poets Orchestra, but the song was Cry Freedom.
Which we should do very often, because freedom is a good thing.
Yes.
We're back. Tonight we're speaking with Nick Redfern, who is a legend in the field of paranormal explorations. And we're going to be talking now about his new trilogy of books. Welcome back, Nick.
Thanks, guys.
I finished reading Bloodline of the Gods and Weapon of the Gods, which are the first two books in a trilogy, which will include Immortality of the Gods. I'm very impressed with what I've read so far. I guess we'll start with Bloodline of the Gods. That was a very interesting hypothesis. I don't know if I have Rh negative blood, but my wife does. She is kind of otherworldly. I can vouch for that. I'm not afraid she's going to take over the planet, or, you know, if she does, I'll be okay.
Great.
It was secret. Nick, you blew it. What made you focus on this particular part of our genetic heritage and tie it into alien hybridization?
Well, you know, it's when I'm sort of writing a book or coming up with an idea, I always try and put myself in the position of not just being a writer, but also as a reader of paranormal books. And so one of the things you always want to give the audience is something new to look at. You know, you don't want to just go over old ground, you know, just recycling stuff. And so what I thought about doing was writing a book that would look into this issue of the small percentage of the human race that are known as Rh negatives. That's to say their blood is actually quite distinctly different from the rest of the population. Now, you could say quite legitimately that this is just an anomaly, in the same way that some people have brown hair, some have blonde hair, you know, some have red hair. But it actually gets much deeper than that, because one of the important factors is the way in which so many people today who are Rh negative, but who are actually in the minority in terms of relation to the rest of the population, even though they're a smaller number, their figures for having UFO experiences and alien encounters and being drawn to the UFO subject are actually really high. And we can trace back the Rh negative lineage, basically, which essentially means they have like a different protein in their blood, but it can have major adverse effects on, if say, for example, an Rh positive woman becomes pregnant by an Rh negative man, the woman's body actually tries to kill off the Rh negative fetus as it's growing. And, you know, so we have a lot of weird stuff like that. So, in other words, we're seeing a situation where people who are Rh negative are drawn to the UFO subject, they have these weird anomalies, and we can trace it back to early man like Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthals. So I focused on this theory that the idea that of us potentially being somebody's genetic experiments tens and tens of thousands of years ago. And the publisher New Page liked that, and they said, would you be interested in sort of turning it into a trilogy? And so I said, yeah, you know, providing I can come up with three interesting angles for the trilogy. And so the second one, which has been out about a month, 2 months now, called Weapons of the Gods, looks at this idea of could there have been ancient nuclear warfare in the distant past, whether involving early human civilizations that reached incredible levels but destroyed themselves and may have prompted things like the legends of Atlantis, or involving extraterrestrials that sort of use the planet for their turf wars, or a combination of the two. And then the third one, Immortality of the Gods, which comes out in December of this year, that'll sort of round the three books off. And that one looks at the issue of, as the title suggests, immortality in relation to extraterrestrials, both in the distant past and right through to the present.
I'm looking forward to reading that, and I enjoyed the books. Weapons of the Gods surprised me because the promotional material that I was sent, it seemed, after I read the promotional material and started reading the book, that this was going to be kind of like an update on all these different theories that are floating around, especially on ancient aliens and shows like that. But it was actually a lot more. You took each of these cases that are listed in the book, and you looked at their reality. So you didn't just feed evidence into there were ancient civilizations or extraterrestrials that had nuclear wars and support. You had us look at the whole question from a bit more critical standpoint, and I greatly appreciated that.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, the reason I did that is because if you're going to talk about nuclear war tens of thousands of years ago and civilizations that flourished and then destroyed themselves, you know, it's a highly controversial issue. So, in other words, you have to be balanced and provide the reader with the, you know, that particular version of events, but then also let them know that, you know, there are different interpretations, and we always need to be sort of mindful of the fact that we don't get caught in that sort of Fox Mulder, I want to believe scenario. You know, we want to go with evidence. But as I pointed out in the book, if I didn't think there was a good chance that some of these stories could well have been ancient nuclear war, like, for example, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, we're a classic case. If I didn't think there was nothing to it, I would never have written the book, you know. So I do actually, you know, personally believe something along those lines did go on. Now, whether it involved ancient aliens, highly advanced but localized and isolated pockets of humans who developed much quicker than the rest of the planet and then paid the price, or a combination of the two, you know, I think it's more likely a combination that perhaps visiting extraterrestrials, you know, sort of mingled with early man. And that's why we have these stories of things like, you know, the Anunnaki coming down and taking human wives, and the Nephilim and the giants. You know, I think if you take away the simplistic approach, it actually sounds like sort of ancient genetic engineering, that kind of thing.
I'm Greek, and Greeks, at least when I was growing up, were raised with, you know, peculiar ideas. We were told as children that we're not Europeans. We're descended from Olympians. And this was before genetic experimentation had permeated the public consciousness. So the process was described as selective breeding, which is how it appears in the mythologies.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point because, you know, you're lucky in the sense that Greece and ancient Rome and some of the other sort of local areas and countries, they have this sort of rich history of the gods, you know. And of course, some people say, well, that's just mythology. Other people interpret the stories literally. And then, as you say, you have the extraterrestrial angle, which, you know, you can sort of bring this into the story, if you like, that the ancient people of those eras interpreted them as all-powerful gods because that's how they seemed to them. But, you know, they may actually have been highly advanced, scientifically, technologically advanced extraterrestrials.
And they were tied to the planets and the constellations. So even in antiquity, they had that connection with space.
Yeah, I mean, most cultures around the world, whether it's like in the UK with Stonehenge, ancient Sumeria, you know, the people of Mesopotamia, they were, you know, heavily influenced by the stars. Ancient Greek, ancient Rome, you know, they had their deities, their gods were named after the planets and so forth. And the same in Egypt, you know, there was this sort of, you know, worship of the stars and the planets and sun gods and earth gods and so on in other countries. So, in other words, at some point, something happened in our distant past when higher entities, if you like, came down and were interacted to the extent that it essentially sort of gave birth to the, you know, the origins of human civilization. And, you know, I think there's a good case can be made that somebody deliberately decided to do that. You know, let's take this sort of fairly dangerous wild creature, genetically alter it, and give the planet some sort of stability and civilization to it.
And now we're finding too, like for instance, I am a type 2 diabetic. I was diagnosed maybe 5 years or so ago, and the type I have makes me very susceptible to grains and things like that. So if the gods gave us agriculture, which they're credited with doing through much of the world, the gods cannot be all-knowing, because diabetes and a lot of the diseases of civilization, as they're called, are in reaction to agricultural foods and other modified type of livestock. So to me, that lends further credibility that somebody did something because they didn't get it right.
Well, yeah, I mean, you make a good point there, because as I point out in the next book, Immortality of the Gods, you know, you can find stories of not just the gods living immortal lives, but occasionally they would share the secrets with certain humans. You know, you can find in most ancient religious texts, there are stories of humans who magically were given, you know, the power, if you like, of immortality. And when you look at these stories, again, you can potentially, like you just pointed out with diabetes, you know, were the gods, the aliens, sort of reckless in providing certain factions of the human race immortality, and then the rest of them sort of become jealous and, you know, they're desperate for the secrets, and it creates a lot of turmoil, which they could have avoided had they not giving it to anybody at all, you know.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm assuming you're going to have Melchizedek and Enoch and Methuselah and...
They're all in there. And also, you know, it looks at the theories that are sort of floating around today as to how immortality could be achieved. Like, for example, the technology surrounding what's known as white powder gold. And I also tie it in with, you know, like the Indian immortality elixir called Amrita, and there's like a Chinese equivalent, and some people have drawn parallels with the manna from the Bible, you know, this sort of magical food that kept the Israelites fed. And again, you can find stories like this everywhere, and, you know, you can go back to things like the Bible, like you said, and Enoch, you know, Methuselah and Noah having massively extensive lifespans, and you know, maybe these stories aren't just legends and folklore. Maybe, you know, visiting extraterrestrials really had achieved immortality. And I mean, if we look at where our technology is going now, you know, the idea that one day we might actually not die is not implausible, because there's a great deal of mystery surrounding why people age and why some people seem to age quicker than others, you know, and some look younger longer and things like that. And, you know, if we could understand why we only get sort of our 85 or, you know, close to 90 years now, why is it? What is it that triggers the sort of alarm clock to go off to say, okay, it's time for them to start degrading now, you know? And that's sort of one of the things that white powder gold and some of these ancient elixirs may have done, is to actually halt the aging process. And as I said, if we could do it, well, I mean, it would be amazing, but also there would be big issues. You know, if nobody ever dies in rapid time, the planet would be overrun by people.
A lot of the stories we grew up with as children, I'm almost 60, a lot of the stories I grew up with as a child on Atlantis and ancient civilizations, they're part of our reality already in the here and now.
Well, and, yeah, I mean, a lot of these stories have, you know, they're so powerful stories. They've sort of endured since, you know, well, with Atlantis, since Plato's time, you know, and he told the story. But, I mean, there's a very weird story to give you a sort of a little a peek, so to speak, into the immortality of the gods books. You know, there are rumors that when the invasion of Iraq occurred, there was, you know, obviously we know the reason why they invaded Iraq. You know, it was oil and Hussein, etc. But there's a long-standing rumors that there was a sort of a top-secret program that was designed to try and figure out the secrets of immortality from ancient Iraq, and this allegedly focused on a military unit going on and trying to find the secrets of the ancient King Gilgamesh, who actually report was a demigod in the sense that he was sort of half human, half god, and lived for an extensive lifespan, but he didn't achieve immortality. And there are a lot of weird rumors floating around that the military was looking for ancient artifacts in Iraq that could be brought back and to try and understand the technology behind immortality, which in this case I'm sure would almost certainly be provided, you know, for an elite rather than for the rest of us cattle, you know.
Zechariah and Sitchin's last few books dealt with that, if I remember correctly. The King Who Would Not Die was one of the books he wrote, and I forget what the other title was, but it also dealt
with... I think that one was his novel that he did on Gilgamesh.
Yes.
You know, this, which is a really interesting story about Gilgamesh being a demigod, but he didn't have full immortality. And the story, he gets more and more panicky, you know, that he's got to find this elixir, which reportedly is sort of deep under the ocean. And I mean, obviously, the story's been distorted in a simplistic sort of tale where it becomes like a, almost like a parable in some respects. But on the other hand, a lot of these ancient stories, there's always a bit of truth in them. And if Gilgamesh was sort of part human, part extraterrestrial, part Anunnaki, who knows, that he may have had the genes that allowed him to live, or to actually to rule for like 130 years, but he knew that his time was still limited. And, you know, and it's kind of like a, I wouldn't say it's a sad story, but it's like a, you know, it's a story of this guy trying to keep death at bay, and, you know, finally he doesn't manage to do that.
Yeah, it's a timeless tale and very deep, and he lost his friend, you know, Enkidu, and
that's right, yeah.
Life had lost meaning after that.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, if people say, you know, would you want to live forever? Well, I would, you know, if I could sort of stop the aging process at the age you want to stop it at. You know, nobody
that's
wants to stop the age of 97 or something, you know. So there would be big questions. I mean, you know, what if they found a way that everybody could be sort of turned off, so to speak, at 25, you know, and nobody ever got out older than 25? People might find that a bit strange, you know. So other people might want to be 45 or 35, and who knows. So if it happens, you know, there will be a lot of, or if it could happen, a lot of questions are going to be asked, I think.
Years ago, John Borman did a movie called Zardoz, which examined this. You know, the elite of the Earth, they were granted immortality and youth, and they went out into outer space and then returned. And in the meanwhile, the Earth had become a barbaric and savage place to live. So they created a religion to control the savages, and to guarantee that they were able to produce food. And, of course, one of the immortals couldn't resist playing with the savages and genetically manipulating them. And it was a really interesting story, but it dealt with that. You know, what would life be like if you could live forever? What if you weren't young when they found immortality and now you're doomed to eternal senility or something?
Well, you'd be like the character in the Aztecs.
Well, I mean, that's why there'd be big questions, you know. I mean, if when it's developed or if it's found, you know, the secret to immortality, could the aging process be reversed, you know? I mean, or would it just be a case of being stopped when you're ready to stop it? In that sense, you know, again, that's sort of another question that would come along as to how and why, you know, this process works and the implications of actually sort of engaging in it, you know, and should we even do that? You know, I mean, there's actually an interesting movie that came out. I don't know if you've actually seen it. It came out about a year ago called The Age of Adeline, and it's about this young woman who has this act where she doesn't age. You know, it's like in the 1920s, and she has to sort of, you know, she sees that all the people she loves around are dying, and so she avoids relationships until she meets this guy who she falls in love with, who, you know, has a regular lifespan, and, you know, and it deals with probably the everyday circumstances that would occur. But as I said, there are mysteries. You know, why is it that somebody, you know, you look at someone, you think, well, are they 30 or are they 40 or are they an old-looking 24? You know, sometimes you get that. We don't know why that happens. You know, we don't really understand. Why is it that, you know, a dog might live to sort of 15 or 16, the average dog? You know, cats sometimes live to about 17, 18. You know, gorillas can live to their 40s. Why is it that there's a time limit on different animals? Why is 85 or whatever?
Nick, we've run out of time. I am going to invite you back when the book Immortality of the Gods comes out. We can continue this conversation. And then I'm going to ask if you can give suggestions to folks who might want to investigate local mysteries or more global mysteries. In the interim, how can folks connect with the things that you're doing?
Well, I have a blog which is titled World of Whatever. So just Google Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, and that will take you to my blog. My Twitter account is Nick Redfern UFO, and also you can reach me on Facebook. There's a bunch of Nick Redferns on Facebook, but I'm on the list somewhere, so to speak. And I'm always pleased to chat with people if they want advice or they want to share a story and they want, you know, somebody to help give them some answers as to what happened to them. You know, again, I'm always happy to do that. And as far as the books are concerned, they're all available off Amazon, and most of them are available in Barnes & Noble as well.
Well, thank you. I'm greatly honored that you graced us with your presence tonight. I wish you the best and look forward to enjoying the fruits of your future work.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for having me on again.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Okay, that was Nick Redfern. I'm looking forward to the next time we have him on. I checked the Oracle, and the Oracle is strangely silent, so we have no CERN updates for tonight. What are we doing, Athena?
Well, on Saturday, July 2nd, Hercules will be at the Amber Dragon with a discussion of the seven heavens, the sun. And for more information on Hercules and Athena, visit our website at www.herculesinvictus.net. For contact and community, visit us on Facebook at Hercules Invictus, Mythic Atlantis, or The Voice of Olympus. Hercules and Athena are also available for Olympian workshops, mythic activities, as well as epic special events and appearances.
And our next show, 1 week from tonight, on July 4th, will be Prosperity Quest number 2. And we're having on Anthony Hernandez for the first time. He is the developer of the Enlightened Savage conditioning program. And we also have the return of DC Russ, who last time left the show with some startling revelations. So I'm looking forward to continuing with that. And if we can get her, Christine Evron, the president of the Tenafly Chamber of Commerce, will be returning with a litany of all that is wonderful about Tenafly, which I agree with. Anyway, thank you for joining us tonight. Until next week, this is Hercules Invictus
and Athena Victory.
Joyous journeys and happy adventures.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.